This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to talk with Donald Johnson. He's the Assistant Professor of History at North Dakota State University, one of them at any rate, and the author of a brand new book, Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Why did you write the book?
So I was originally searching, it was when I was in graduate school about 10 years ago, searching around for a seminar paper. And it was in the midst of kind of one of the worst periods of the American occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I had been studying the American Revolution, and it got me thinking that there were vast swaths of what is now the United States that were occupied by British forces during the Revolutionary War. And I hadn't yet read any good histories on how that affected the outcome of the revolution, and had an interest in what historians call kind of popular politics, the effects of ordinary people and their beliefs and mobilization during the revolution. And I thought those topics kind of intersected well. So I went and did a case study of Charleston, South Carolina, and its occupation from 1780 to 1782, and found that there was a much larger story there that was connected through the six different cities that I talk about in the book, Boston, Philadelphia, New York, Charleston, Savannah, Georgia, and Newport, Rhode Island. And there was just a larger story and a lot going on in these areas that historians had not studied before. So I thought it would make a really good candidate for a book project.
Well, the book is titled Occupied America. And Professor Johnson, let's just sort of set the scene here. The occupation by British forces followed years of efforts by revolutionaries to, you know, get their movement going, didn't it?
Yeah, what happened was the occupations began in almost as soon as the war started in April of 1775. And they were really preceded by what I call kind of revolutionary occupations, the overthrow of British governments in each colony, which occurred between 1774 and the early year months of 1776. And by March of 1776, when the British pull out of Boston, revolutionary control of most of the 13 colonies is mostly uncontested. The revolutionaries have done a pretty good job of both militarily and politically quelling opposition and asserting control, kind of replacing former colonial governments with new republican governments. That said, though, there are a lot of people in the colonies who don't support these new revolutionary governments, and especially in the cities, which were nodes of commerce and connection to Britain's empire, which spanned from India to Europe, West Africa, the Caribbean, and of course the North American colonies. And so for a lot of people in cities, the idea was that a return to the British Empire would be good economically, would restore their kind of social status, and it would give some stability in a turbulent kind of war. And the British kind of had that same idea. They had the idea that if they could take control of the cities in what had become the United States, what they referred to as the rebelling colonies, they could then use those as bases to kind of go out into the countryside and suppress the rebellion. And so this was really crucial to the British strategy of fighting the revolution. But what happened was that neither side kind of got what they expected. When the British entered these towns, they were kind of expecting a loyal population, a population that would support them in their war effort and make sacrifices on behalf of the king. Whereas local citizens and urban dwellers were expecting that British forces would come in and restore them back to the status quo antebellum, to this kind of prosperous period of the 1750s and 1760s, in which cities were growing at an enormous rate, and connections to other parts of the empire. They were importing things and selling things all across the world. And neither of those things happened. There were economic hardships brought on by the British Army, and the British Army did not receive the fulsome support that they wanted. And so the situation deteriorated in all six cities pretty quickly after British forces arrived.
Let's talk about the nature of this conflict, because if the British had won, if they'd prevailed, this would have been like a civil war. These were all citizens of Great Britain who were at odds, one on one side of the Atlantic, the other on the other. And those colonists were not of a singular ideology, if you will. You've got all these loyalists, you've got revolutionaries, and you've got people in between walking a tightrope.
Yeah, exactly. That's a really good point. I mean, the revolution itself, and historians are recognizing this more and more, was a civil war not only within the British Empire, but on the North American continent itself. The classic estimate for the number of loyalists, the number of patriots, and the number of what he called kind of disaffected or neutrals was made by John Adams in 1776, and he estimated that about a third of the population of British North America favored independence, and a third of the population favored sticking with the crown, and about a third of the population could kind of go either way depending on personal circumstances or which side had more strength in their particular area. And so, yeah, it definitely was a conflict that's much more nuanced and much more muddy than a lot of our popular memory of it has. You know, we have movies like The Patriot or musicals like Hamilton, which kind of give us this idea that it was heroic patriots fighting against this kind of oppressive army. When in fact, both sides kind of thought they were fighting for freedom. Both sides kind of thought they were fighting for their own liberties. For loyalists and for British soldiers, that liberty, that freedom was kind of the constitutional monarchy of Great Britain, which they viewed as the freest society ever created. And they feared that the revolutionaries would devolve into kind of demagoguery and chaos and anarchy or dictatorship. For the revolutionaries, the story is more familiar, right? It's fighting for kind of individual liberties against the monarchy of Great Britain and the unjust acts passed by the British Parliament on the colonists without their consent. And then you've got this vast amount of people kind of stuck in the middle, and these are, you know, what I like to call kind of ordinary Americans. These are shopkeepers, farmers, innkeepers, business people, you know, people who are just trying to live their lives, keep their families intact during this crisis and during the violence. And it's those stories that I think really are underserved by our histories of the revolution. But in the story of occupation, they really come to the front because, you know, one of the key narratives that happens during this period is the shift of a lot of those people, not necessarily towards revolutionary government, but away from the possibility of restored British government through their experiences under occupation.
Donald Johnson is the author of Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. And Donald, one of the more interesting aspects of the book as I was scanning it was that the historical fact that occupiers, the British, were taking advantage of disadvantaged minorities like slaves and Native Americans. Blacks were fighting with British in the colonial South. Native Americans were assisting the British on the western rural areas of the country. So this revives all kinds of issues that still prevail today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that the British were not ignorant of the schisms in colonial society. In fact, they had kind of helped create some of them with their policies and governance before the war. And so one of the things they do is both to try to weaken the rebel cause and to strengthen their own efforts to restore the empire is take advantage, yeah, of some of those enmities in terms of Native Americans. The vast majority of Native Americans, and there's been work done on this by other scholars in much more detail, but the vast majority of Native Americans, including, I believe, 4 out of the 6 Iroquois nations, as well as the Creeks and the Choctaw, who were the prominent tribe, or the Creeks and the Cherokee, excuse me, were the prominent tribes in the South, all sided with the British Empire. Because they were afraid of what would happen if an independent United States existed and was unable to restrain settlers coming west over the Appalachians and into their territory. And they believed in the British ability to kind of restrict that movement and protect their ancestral lands over that of the United States. The other element, and this is, you know, the one that is potentially, you know, more relevant to our current situation, is that the British Army and the British government took full advantage of the existence of a large enslaved population to kind of attempt to turn colonial society on its head. And it granted enslaved people both freedom and opportunity in the British Army and in occupied territories if they fled plantations, if they came under British lines. Many of them ended up serving in the British Army, both as soldiers, but also as what in the 18th century they called pioneers, what we would think of as kind of engineers, people who dug trenches, followed the army, built roads, et cetera, et cetera. And for a lot of these people, you know, it was a game changer, an opportunity for freedom that had never existed before. One of the stories that I share in the book is that of the enslaved carpenter Boston King. And King was born in an enslaved person on a plantation in rural South Carolina. Once the British occupied Charleston, he heard of the offers of freedom that were being sent out from the British camp, kind of packs his bags and heads out to Charleston, and ends up having kind of a really interesting 2-year wartime career. You know, he serves first as a personal servant to a British officer, which is the first gig that he ever had where he was paid for his services. He then joins up on a British privateer, so he goes to sea, and ends up at the end of the war in occupied New York City, working as a carpenter, where he then kind of reinvents his life again, becomes a leader in the free black community in New York, marries another former enslaved person, and ends up after the war immigrating to Canada, to Nova Scotia, and becoming a Methodist preacher and a leader of a loyalist settlement in Nova Scotia, which is kind of as far from a life on a South Carolina plantation as you can get. So for a lot of these people, the experience of occupation and the war could create fundamental changes in their lives, and not always for the worse. I mean, in the case of Boston King, occupation and war kind of changed his life for the better, and for historians estimate as many as 20 to 30,000 this was the case.
This also had an interesting effect, all this tumult that was happening in these port cities, and for that matter, elsewhere in the colonies, created opportunities for the dare I say it, the liberation of women.
Absolutely. There's been a great deal of interest in women during the American Revolution. And under occupation, what happened was a lot of men were politically put on the sidelines. They were considered threats potentially to the British regimes, even when they professed their loyalty. because of economic embargoes and the, like you said, the tumult of the war. They were often unable to provide for their families. And women had opportunities to kind of self-liberate, to kind of get away from under the thumb of fathers and brothers and sometimes even husbands who previously would have controlled their day-to-day lives. One of the people that I found in my research who was the most fascinating was an innkeeper in Newport, Rhode Island named Mary Almy. Almy ran an inn that had been co-run by her husband, Benjamin Almy. Benjamin volunteers for the Continental Army really early in the war in 1775. So he's gone for much of this time period. But Mary Almy becomes a loyalist when the British Army comes to Newport at the end of 1776 and occupies the town for the next 3 years. She opens her doors to British soldiers. She socializes with them. She hosts them. And she even writes this kind of series of letters, which her descendants hid for the next 75 years. They weren't discovered until the 1850s because they contained a lot of her loyalist thoughts, which are really quite fascinating. She writes to her husband basically saying that, you know, she loves him and she hopes he is safe, but she hopes that the British Army destroys the Continental Army and that the next time she sees him, he is a prisoner on parole in Newport. So they have this kind of vast political disagreement that would have been unheard of in other times.
Well, your book reminds me of the inner strife in the Franklin family, because Benjamin Franklin, one of the fathers of the Revolution, had a son, William Franklin, who was the loyalist governor of New Jersey and who ultimately worked to form units to help the British.
Yeah, and William Franklin's actually a really prominent figure in British-occupied New York for a lot of the war. He arrives kind of late. He was imprisoned by his own legislature and then held in Connecticut for the first couple years of the conflict. But yeah, once he arrives in New York in 1778, he immediately starts kind of forming these loyalist militias to go out into the countryside and the surrounding regions and plunder and kind of raid revolutionary and Continental Army posts. So yeah, I mean, he was an inveterate loyalist, and it really shaped Franklin's views on what became known as the loyalist question towards the end of the war, kind of when the writing was on the wall and the two sides were negotiating for peace in 1781 and 1782. Most of the negotiators, the British negotiators, kind of were demanding some concessions for loyalists who lost property or family or were damaged. And Franklin, kind of with this personal grudge against his own son, is adamant that the United States agreed to no such terms, and that those who betrayed, in his eyes, kind of betrayed the cause of their country, be given no support from the government. And this is, you know, a position that ultimately isn't taken by the United States. They do agree to provide some help to loyalists, and a majority of loyalists actually end up reintegrating into the new United States after the Revolution. There's a minority, about 75,000 people, who flee, who are exiled to Canada or Great Britain or the British Caribbean. But a lot of them end up kind of making their peace with the new republic.
You talk about the economic importance of many of these loyalists, and I guess the reality is the war is over, and your last chapter in the book is Forgetting Occupation. The winners get to write the history, and it's kind of convenient to, you know, get things back to some sort of normal.
You're exactly right on the economic importance of this. I mean, one of the foremost advocates for loyalist reintegration was Alexander Hamilton, who thought in primarily economic terms. And his idea was that, yes, you know, these loyalists fought against or acted against the interests of the United States. But if we jettison them, if we exile them, we're potentially losing a massive base of capital, as well as a massive skill set. You know, a lot of these people were prominent lawyers, businessmen, politicians, people who knew, who had the skills that the United States needed to kind of build the new country. So, and in the end, the argument for kind of a lenient treatment of loyalists wins out. The thing that I observed, you know, and that I write about in the last chapter of the book is that so long as loyalists kind of were repentant or were able to kind of portray their actions as indiscretions or being kind of duped by the British, historians of the revolution in the early period were really and you know what we might call journalists writing about the revolution in the newspapers were pretty easily swayed and able to forgive them. One of the most striking things I found in reading the earliest histories of the revolution by people like David Ramsey of South Carolina and Mercy Otis Warren of Massachusetts is actually how few loyalists they actually name and how much they go out of their way to kind of excuse the loyalism of ordinary Americans. They kind of say, well, they were forced into it by force of arms or by economic circumstances or by false promises by the British. But once they saw kind of the light of day, they sided with the revolutionaries. One of the key points of this is a man called Tench Coxe, who was a wealthy merchant in Philadelphia during the occupation of that city. And no man, you know, in the city could have clearly been more of a loyalist than Coxe. You know, he made his money basically exploiting connections with the British Army to get trading licenses to send ships to the Caribbean and bring back and import goods. But after the war, he kind of repudiates the British cause. He writes an essay in one of the Philadelphia papers in which he calls his former loyalism kind of a youthful indiscretion. And he ends up having a quite successful political career after the war. He serves in Alexander Hamilton's Treasury Department, and then under President Jefferson, he rises to Assistant Secretary of the Treasury and writes a very influential treatise on political economy, which shapes theories in the early republic. He also serves in Congress. And it's funny, kind of whenever his loyalism is brought up, people almost treat it as an unfair attack. People almost treat it as something like, you know, well, that was the past and we all did things in the war that we're not proud of, but let's move on.
Donald Johnson is an assistant professor of history at North Dakota State University and the author of the new book out by the University of Pennsylvania Press, Occupied America, British Military Rule and the Experience of Revolution. Professor Johnson, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states, with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
Coming up on Main Street, Tom Ezern with a Plainsfolk essay, and our conversations with candidates on the statewide ballot continue. We'll talk with Josh Gallion. He's seeking re-election to the office of auditor. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota Public Employees Retirement System has decided to stay with the Sanford Health Plan. The plan will cover state employees' health insurance. Sanford has been the insurance provider since 2015. The contract remains in the current structure in that state workers will still receive a fully paid plan, and it will remain a bundled medical and pharmacy plan. Scott Miller is the executive director of PERS.
Sanford also submitted by far the lowest cost proposal. We'll be saving the state of North Dakota and our political subdivisions millions and millions of dollars over the next biennium.
Miller says the proposal includes wellness programs Sanford has offered in the past. He says the level of satisfaction among state workers concerning the Sanford plan is very high. Much of the Great Plains is experiencing drought. As Harvest Public Media's Christina Stella reports, a lack of fall rain could spell problems for farmers in the spring.
After a muddy harvest last year, some Plains farmers are relishing being done by Halloween. With crops almost in, Brian Fuchs at the National Drought Center says the soil has one job now, recharge.
Any moisture that we can add into the soil now before the soils freeze up is going to be moisture that is available next spring when we plant that next crop.
Regional weather is skewing warm and dry right now. If conditions don't change, some crops could struggle next season.
I'm pretty nervous about where we're going into the 2021 production year. Out in the western Nebraska, winter wheat has been planted into some fairly dry soils. You know, that crop is off to a poor start.
Given the La Nina weather pattern, southern states are likely to stay dry, while the north sees snow and rain. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
Most of North Dakota is experiencing abnormally dry conditions with some pockets of drought. And Cass County voters are getting the chance to vote in person as of today.
We have three locations open today. The Fargo Dome opened up at 9 o'clock this morning. They're open till 7. Ramada Inn, same hours. And the Doubletree in West Fargo. So far, just a few minutes ago, they all three reported in. They had about 1,000 voters altogether.
Cass County Auditor Mike Montpleasure says 1,000 ballots cast in the first 2 hours builds on what has already been a busy election season.
We have sent out 39,145 ballots, and we've receipted back in 17,311, and we probably have a few thousand that we haven't receipted back in yet that we need to get caught up on. That's a process. You know, when the ballots come back in, you know, for instance, we probably got 3,000 today. Then you have to find the original application, marry it up to them, and then receipt it into the system. So we probably have close to 20,000 or more ballots in already.
Montpleasure says as of Monday of next week, three additional polling places will open. He says with the increased population and increased interest, he is expecting the normal 80,000 votes to cast to increase to possibly 90,000 in this year's general election. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. We started our show with an NDSU history professor. Here's another. Tom Ezern is a scholar and author and balladeer. His Plains Folk essays are a regular feature of our show, and in today's essay titled A Farmer's Son, Tom draws on his personal history.
I may not know who I am, but I know where I came from. So writes Wallace Stegner, Pulitzer Prize winner and prairie boy, in an essay I assign every fall to my students in the history of the Great Plains. Stegner here addresses what he calls the question mark in the circle, the identity question. Who am I? What am I doing here? Likewise, in the prologue to my own book, Pacing Dakota, I make homage to the greatest of all poets of the Plains, William Stafford, with lines from his poem, Farm on the Great Plains. A telephone line goes cold. Birds tread it wherever it goes. A farm back of a great plain tugs an end of the line. Stafford may be feeling forlorn about the disconnection of his life from that farm back of a great plain where mother is not at home, father is not at home. But the poem is more about resolve. Stafford resolves to be the plain. Here a few days ago, I was feeling a little forlorn myself, laid up and hurting from an accident. But then I had the opportunity to sing to a virtual gathering of friends a couple of songs from my grandmother's ballad book. A Farmer's Son Am I was the first one, and after that, Hello Central, Give Me Heaven. You probably never heard of these old songs, but I tell you, they lit up the telephone line of memory that spans a lifetime to the back of that plane. Because, yeah, I know where I came from, but now and then I need a reminder. I am frequently heard to remark, sometimes in this broadcast, that I am a farmer. A critic might tell me, no, you're not a farmer, you're just a landlord, the heir of a farm. But that raises the issue of what it means to be heir to a piece of land, and be affected by an old song like, "A farmer's son am I." Like most farmers' sons of my generation, especially if they happened to have older brothers who were capable farmers, I left the home place for another line of work, as an academic historian. My dissertation, however, was a history of custom wheat harvesting on the Great Plains of North America, which set me on the yellow road toward being not just a professor, but a scholar of agricultural history and prairie life, a farm boy historian. The academy has been a place of tenuous tenure all my life, but I have been fortunate in my professional career. More to the point, though, I have job security in that no matter how many essays I deliver, how many books I write, I will never be done telling the story of farm and prairie, which is good. I'm a little long in the tooth to buck bales or throw calves, but I can tell stories. And sometimes sing them. The theme song for my weekly webcast, the Willow Creek Folk School, starts out. On the great western prairies, I do the work of the Lord. My saddle's my pillow, and I preach from my board. Well, there was a time during the folky days back in the last century when I made rent with my guitar and songs, and so now, even as I approach my 80, as I have taken up regular public singing again, it's another instance of returning to my roots. We light up the mic from our place on Willow Creek, and sure enough, people gather around virtually. Just like on account of these weekly pieces on Prairie Public, everywhere I go, people come up and introduce themselves because they recognize my voice. Please feel free to do so yourself. The lines are still live. Myself will be the plane.
That's Tom Ezrin. Next on our show, North Dakota State Auditor Josh Gallion.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Josh Gallion. He's the incumbent North Dakota State Auditor. He's a Republican, and he's running for re-election. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Give our listeners a little of the Josh Gallion background. How did you get here?
Well, I got to North Dakota. I am not a born and raised North Dakotan. I was stationed here after high school as a member of the United States Air Force at Minot Air Force Base back in 1998. As a 19-year-old kid, I thought this was probably the worst thing that could have ever happened to me, that they were sending me to the edge of the earth. I had to look it up on a map to find out where it was. But lo and behold, over 20 years later, I met my wife in Minot. We have two awesome daughters, and North Dakota is now its home. And we've been here, and I can't imagine a better place to work, live, raise a family. I love North Dakota. I love the culture. I love the people. And it's an honor to serve the citizens as their state auditor.
Why are you running for another term? You've done this for about 4 years. What prompts you to keep doing it?
Well, for me, my message this term is the same. I'm fighting for effective and responsive government that is transparent and accountable to the people. And over this first term, these last 4 years, we've made some tremendous strides in improving our communication, improving the understandable readability of our audit reports, making sure that we are actively putting information in the hands of the people. But there's still so many more things that we want to accomplish here in the office that I really want to push forward with. And that's where I hope, if given another term, really want to focus on more training development, supporting some of the local government entities, rebuilding the local government audit function. A lot of people here in North Dakota may not realize, but we've got over 1,900 local government entities operating throughout the state, most of which have to have their financials reviewed and are reviewed by the auditor's office if they don't get an audit. And so really trying to help support local government, that's really something that I want to focus on going forward, while maintaining all of the amazing things that we've been able to accomplish with our agency audits, with our federal mineral royalty audits that we conduct out west. But there's a lot more that we can accomplish for promoting transparent, accountable government.
What are the duties of North Dakota's state auditor?
The auditor's office is responsible for conducting the post-audit of financial transactions to identify deficiencies, irregularities in our government transactions. And we do that with state agencies. We do that with higher education. We do that in local governments. And I mentioned our federal mineral royalty. So on federal lands out west, we conduct those audits on behalf of the federal government to make sure that they are getting the fair share of those mineral royalty payments. The benefit of looking at it from that perspective, though, we also know what the local governments should be getting, the counties, the cities. And so there really isn't a level of government in North Dakota that the auditor's office doesn't have a role in. And so that's probably one of the broadest jurisdictions. But for me, having an opportunity to positively impact government at every level is really what encourages me every day.
So you do financial audits. You also do performance audits, don't you?
Correct.
And what's the difference there?
So the financial statement audits, we look at the financial statements to make sure that everything is on the up and up, that they have proper, you know, financials. I want to say going concern, but governments aren't really a going concern, but it's an accurate representation of management. The performance audits really look at the processes and the results. Are we achieving the desired outcomes? Most of our state agency audits, our performance audits, our local government audits, are the financial statement audits. And then with the federal mineral royalty, we do a lot of those reviews.
When somebody is audited and you go into a county commission review, or you go to another state agency, is there some money that costs? And if so, is it the agency you're auditing's responsibility to pay that, or does your office cover that expense?
Well, that depends on the audit, depends on the client. If it is a state agency, and we just talked about the billing process the other day. So if the state agency is primarily general funded, they don't pay the cost of the audit. But if they have a special fund component, then we do bill for a percentage of that. Local governments, the local government division in the auditor's office really operates like a small business. They do bill for the cost of their audit. That money does come back into an operating fund, and that is what's used to cover their salaries and operating costs.
Former North Dakota Commerce Commissioner Jay Shuler and outgoing Commissioner Michelle Comer have been outspoken in their criticism of the way you conducted an audit of their agency. What's your response to the kerfuffle that blew up around the Commerce Commissioner's office?
Well, I do stand by the work in the auditor's office. They conducted a thorough review, followed the standards. Everything in that audit report is, can be substantiated. We have everything documented in our work papers. And then it's in accordance with the law, we had an obligation to inform the Attorney General's office of the outcome of that report. And from there, I think that's where everything kind of went a little sideways.
There was a criminal investigation as a result of that audit. I don't believe that there was any finding, but nevertheless, there were legal fees that were incurred by Michelle Comer and others in her office that were affected by this. She requested reimbursement. That has been denied. Do you think your agency's audit was a catalyst in her decision to leave public service?
That I do not know. That is a question for her. I will clarify. I think a lot of people talk about the audit and how it identified criminal issues, and that would be incorrect. You will never find an audit identifying anything criminal. That would be beyond the scope of an audit. What we identify are what we call potential non-compliance. If there is something that does not seem to fit within the laws, that is what we identify. That would be one of those deficiencies that would be reported to the Attorney General. They are the ones that do more or less that review, that investigation, to see if there's anything more there. But really, we identify at a very surface level if something does not match up with statutes or appropriations. And that's as far as an audit goes. We do not determine any criminality at all.
When I Googled Josh Gallion, I saw a lot of stuff come back, and usually you don't see this much information about somebody who's running for the office of state auditor. A fair amount came back. You've been getting a lot of blowback from members of your own party, and I think one issue seems to be your practice of releasing publicly the results of the audit before their preferred way of handing it into another agency for some sort of internal review.
What do you mean by internal review of another agency?
I mean, just perhaps giving the governor a heads up or something like that, saying, you know, this is the audit result. We've got some concerns here, and this is going to become public.
So in every single audit, the client always receives a draft report. If there are any recommendations, they are awarded an opportunity to review the audit report and provide responses, which are included in the audit report. And so there are no surprises, especially not for the client, before they're made public. And to me, as a constitutionally elected office holder, I work for the citizens of North Dakota. And I feel like I have an obligation to make sure that I inform the people that I work for of their government. That's where that transparent, accountable piece comes from.
Josh Gallion is the North Dakota State Auditor running for re-election. The opponent on the ballot in November will be Democratic NPL nominee Patrick Hart of Bismarck. How would you contrast your campaign or your approach to the job with what you perceive to be his?
Well, my focus is on my record and my abilities to serve. Again, my focus is on making sure that we have effective and responsive government that is transparent and accountable to the people. And I believe the way you accomplish that is by putting independent, objective information in their hands. That will always be my focus, because again, I believe that an informed and engaged citizen is the best way to preserve and protect our republic.
Well, as you know, North Dakota is a supermajority Republican state, and because of that, I guess there are factions within the party itself that are sometimes colliding. But I'll just give you the last line in Jay Shuler's letter to the Bismarck Tribune, Shuler being the former Commerce Commissioner before Michelle Comer, who's now left. And that last line is, just because he is an incumbent and a Republican, this should not be a reason to reelect this man. Have you spoken to Jay Shuler? What's your response to that kind of very flat, outright public statement?
I have not spoken to Jay Shuler. I don't know that I've really ever spoken to Jay Shuler. He's entitled to his point of view. Again, I believe that making this information available to the citizens of North Dakota is the right thing to do. I believe the people have a right to know how their government is spending their money.
Well, as you mentioned, you came to the state with the Air Force. You got lots of education here. You got your bachelor's at Dickinson, your master's at, UND?
UND.
So you're seeking a second term. How might your first term experience affect your approach to the job the next term?
Well, if I'm given an opportunity, you know, of course, I can't sit here and say that everything we've tried to accomplish has worked out exactly like we had hoped. If given the chance to serve in a second term, one of the things that I really want to try to improve upon is communication. Like everything in life, communication is key. Making sure that we make our information available and we inform the right people at the right time of what's going to be released and available. And I've been working on that for the last year, trying to improve communication with key legislators and key stakeholders so that they are aware that audits and information is going to be available.
Well, you're clearly not afraid of stepping on toes. You audited the governor's office for travel expenses. How's your relationship with Governor Burgum?
Very professional. I mean, when we see each other, it's cordial. He has his job to do, and I have mine. You know, at the end of the day, that's where I, as a constitutional elected office holder, I work for the people. But I will work with anybody in the building who is trying to do the right thing for the citizens of North Dakota.
One more question here. Who audits the office of North Dakota State Auditor?
Well, believe it or not, we actually get audited more than most other agencies. This most recent time, we were audited by Ide Bailey. But we also go through federal reviews, and we also receive what's called a peer review by our National State Auditors Association. And I am pleased to announce that we did get the highest rating this last peer review that was just conducted a few months ago. Again, the auditor's office, we do get all kinds of scrutiny and oversight, and that's even beyond a lot of the internal reviews, the quality assurance reviews that happen internally with our own staff. So we are constantly looking at how we are doing things to make sure that we are adhering to the standards, the laws at the highest possible level so that, again, our work product is consistent, it's objective, so that the citizens of North Dakota can rely on it.
I said one last question. I have another one that just came to mind, and that is that we're in interesting times now. We've got a pandemic everywhere. And of course, the state has this massive industrial development around its oil and gas extraction. Does your office have the resources, the manpower to do what it needs to do?
Well, you know, of course, additional auditors also always allow for additional work, additional oversight into our operations. I would say the area that probably needs the most attention is in the local government area. We have seen a steady decline really in the past 10 years of private auditing firms providing government auditing services to local governments. We've seen a steady decline in the number of accounting students graduating from North Dakota universities, and it's really starting to put a strain on the ability to recruit and retain the staff needed to conduct this work, let alone grow the staff. It's much more challenging just to maintain. Some of that could be the oil and gas industry out west that has really pulled a lot of these skill sets out there for some of their project management, project accounting, to keep all of that stuff organized. And so to me, that would be the area that I think needs additional growth or additional help is in the local government piece, because we get calls all the time from cities, counties, park districts. They lost their auditor and they call us asking, you know, can we conduct that audit for them? Unfortunately, we are at max capacity. We have a waiting list of, last I heard, it was over 20 entities looking for our services. And the last information that one of the audit managers gave me is we are currently owed over 450 audit reports from the private firms alone.
Wow.
And so there is really a backlog out there and a delay in getting some of these audit reports completed. But that to me, if we could help anything, it would be in the local government side to help these local government entities who rely on a lot of these audits for some of their bonding.
Josh Gallion is the North Dakota State Auditor. He's running for re-election. You can find out more about his campaign at joshgallion.com. He also has a Facebook page. Josh, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We all know there are plenty of things that are wrong in the world. But are there things that are going right?
Documenting the facts of human progress is not the same as saying bad things can never happen again. Quite the contrary.
A counterintuitive take on the state of the world in 2020, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public. This is Dakota Datebook for October 19th.
The Second World War brought about many advancements in technology, and one of these was radar, the ability to detect aircraft and other objects at long distances. Early in the war, large stationary ground-based radars helped the British win the Battle of Britain by giving English fighter aircraft advance warning of the incoming German planes. Early radar was also installed on a mountain in the Hawaiian Islands before the attack on Pearl Harbor. And while the radar detected the incoming Japanese planes, they misinterpreted the information and didn't act on it. Later in the war, small radar sets were installed in aircraft with varying results. Enemy aircraft often attacked at night with impunity, so advancements were made to meet the challenge with radar-equipped interceptor aircraft. As time went on, these radar sets were improved, but the pilots had to train on how to use them. One of these was Navy pilot Merle Henry Longnecker from New Rockford, North Dakota. On this date, in 1944, Longnecker and George Krause from Wisconsin were flying F-6F Hellcat radar-equipped fighters out of Charleston Navy Auxiliary Field in Rhode Island for nighttime radar training. They practiced interception on a moonless night with nothing to guide them but their small radar screens. After hours of playing a dangerous cat-and-mouse game of tag over eastern Connecticut, Krause and Longnecker took turns intercepting each other, as they would do with an enemy aircraft. Just after 11 p.m., Merle intercepted Krause's plane near the town of Preston, and his last radio transmission was splash, meaning he had Krause's plane in his sights and could have shot him down. Seconds later, in the pitch-black night, the wings of the two planes met, and both planes were sent careening toward the ground and crashed a quarter mile apart in the hilly woods west of the Preston Library. Both men were killed. Merle's body was sent back to North Dakota and buried at New Rockford, and Krause was buried in Brookfield, Wisconsin. Much of the wreckage still remains in the rugged hills, and the site is considered hallowed ground. In 2016, a memorial was dedicated to the two men. In a garden behind the Preston Library, a large granite bench was installed, etched with pictures of Merle, George, and the plane they flew in the service of our country. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Scott Nelson. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
President Trump has repeatedly rejected climate science. His opponent feels differently.
You know, when Donald Trump thinks about climate change, he thinks hoax. When I think about it, I think jobs.
Could Joe Biden's ambitious plans to tackle climate change become a reality if he were elected? The challenges he might face on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Tuesday on our show, we'll hear from Kelly Armstrong, North Dakota's sole member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He'll join us to talk about his re-election campaign. And we'll hear about Tell Tale, Dakota Folklife and Stories. It's a new project from the North Dakota Council on the Arts. We'll talk about it with state folklorist Troy Geist and Mokoche Studios producer David Swenson. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.